This is Friday on the Other Side on Mind Talk. I'm your host, Dr. Pamela Brewer. Mind Talk is the show that provides you with relationship health and mental health information every day. And on Fridays, we take a look at experiences and concepts that you might not think have a mental health component, but in fact, they do.
I am very pleased to introduce to you James Robinson, who is the founder and executive director of Free to Be. James Robinson, welcome to Mind Talk.
Well, thank you. I am very honored to be here, and I'm excited to be part of the show.
Well, now, James, I want to share a little bit more about your background. You are described as a human and civil rights activist, a public speaker, a commentator, a writer. You have your own radio program, and you're the founder and executive producer of an organization. So what do you do in your busy time?
I think about a vacation someday in the future.
There you go. Probably needs to be at least a month long.
The last time I took one, it literally was a month.
Well, that's good. That's good. The organization that you have formed, Free to Be, is a nonprofit located in Huntsville, Alabama. And the mission of your organization is what?
The mission of Free to Be is very simple. It is to end violence while advocating for the human and civil rights of sexual and gender minorities.
In Huntsville, Alabama.
That's correct. And I created the agency in November of 2009. And at that time and continuing in today, we're the only nonprofit designed with the purpose that we have in the entire state.
That says something interesting, I would suspect, about where you are living and working, does it?
It does. There are several organizations that, since marriage equality was being fought for and achieved, have become visible in the state, but we are a locally founded organization, and there was just a complete vacuum. Other than AIDS service organizations, who do a lot of great work in the community, but they're no longer specifically, in most cases, just about the LGBT community.
Okay.
So in that case, there was a vacuum, and when I created the agency, I had really no understanding of just what that vacuum was like and the need that the agency was going to fill.
Well, it clearly looks like it has been doing extraordinary work since you founded it. I'd like to turn my attention to you personally for a moment. Right now, as we speak, you're running an organization, you're a writer, as I said before. There are many wonderful things that you do. And from the outside looking in, it would appear that you are completely, to the extent that anyone is completely anything, self-assured, involved, happy with your work and your life. But it wasn't always that way, was it?
No, it wasn't. And let me preface by saying that I am a white male, and a white male in Alabama. So throughout my story, there's a lot of white male privilege that can be assumed. And I talk about that regularly when I have conversations, because I believe by using that voice of privilege, I can help change our society to where that no longer exists. So I was born here in Huntsville, Alabama.
Okay.
This is a very religious population, and excuse me, I was raised in a denomination called the Church of Christ, which in the South is very conservative, and I did not learn certain skills because we didn't participate in dances and lots of social events that the other young people participated in. So I didn't really learn dating skills and relationship skills about intimate relationships. And when I was 28, after finishing a political science degree at Auburn University, I came to the understanding that I'm homosexual. And after that, I entered into a world that I knew nothing about, and I knew nothing about healthy relationships. So while going through graduate school at the University of Alabama in Birmingham, where I earned a master's in special education, I started a journey which was full of unhealthy situations. And in that, I became a substance abuser. I was exposed to crack cocaine and eventually methamphetamine. And long story short, 10 years later, after I had become an IV user of methamphetamine, and after my second arrest, I decided it was time to change my life. My teaching career had been ruined. I had taught in four school systems in Alabama and Georgia, and I came home to Huntsville. My parents said they wanted me to come home and reconnect to the family, and the message I got was, "Your mother and I love you regardless," from my father, which I wish I had gotten that message many years before that, but I had never told them what I was struggling with. Mm-hmm. So I thought, what am I going to do with the rest of my life? At that point, I had 20-something years of experience working with youth and young adults. So I created an agency. The corporate name is GLBT Advocacy and Youth Services. But in 2014, we finally received some federal funding from the Victims of Crime Act and the Family Violence Prevention and Services Act. So we rebranded as Free to Be, and we created a statewide anti-violence project, which is the Free to Be Safe Anti-Violence Project. And now we have an office in Huntsville, an office in Birmingham. We have youth groups in Huntsville and Mobile, Alabama. And hopefully in October, we'll have an office in Montgomery and a full-time office in Mobile as well. And the Dothan community in southeast Alabama has reached out to create a youth group there too. And the youth groups are for LGBTQ youth and their friends, and they are peer support groups. And they are very important to the population here. We also have adult transgender groups and provide free mental health services to people who have been victims of crime. So that's a very long, complicated story. And recently, I love radio. So a friend of mine had began Alabama's only, if you can believe that, the only liberal talk radio program in the state. It's on WVNN. It's called All That's Left Radio. So now I'm having a lot of fun. That's really what I do in my social time, is the radio show. And I love my life. I have come to a very healthy place. And yeah, it's a journey. And I try to help other people not make the same mistakes. I try to get rid of some of those hurdles that other people who are going through understanding that they might be LGBTQ, finding support. So that's the purpose of what the agency does.
And it's a little late in our conversation to ask you to do this, but if for those who don't know, when you say LGBTQ, what are you referring to?
I'm referring to populations that identify as sexual or gender, or sexual and or gender minority populations, commonly known as lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, queer, and the acronyms actually go much further than that.
Okay, I just wanted to make sure that folks who might not know what that means are clear about the populations that you serve. I'd like to go back to 28, wouldn't we all? You were 28. And that you said that that's when you sort of came to a full awareness of your own homosexuality. What was your life like before that? 28 years old, it's a long time to be living in a skin and not being clear what your skin is that you're living in.
It was. And As I said, I was raised in the Church of Christ, and there's a lot behind saying that. People in the South, in the Deep South, understand exactly what I mean when I say that, but it's a community. The people that I grew up with, I went from nursery in the church through graduating high school with the same group of people. All my social events, mostly except for some at school, were with that same population. And while I value the foundations I received at church, because they are the core of my beliefs today, my beliefs that do unto others as you should do it, as you would like them to do unto you, is the golden rule. But it was still very difficult. I didn't learn how to really think for myself. We are taught how to think, we are taught what to think, and we are taught that the things we are supposed to think are absolutely correct and that there are not other options.
And there's not I was just going to observe that I don't imagine there was a whole lot of space for being anything other than a heterosexual white male who was going to grow up and get married and have babies.
There was absolutely no space for anything other than that. I knew from a very young age, for some reason, that someday I would leave that. I don't know where that came to my spirit, but it was there. So when the time came, it was an easy transition for me. I didn't receive the abuse in the church that many other LGBTQ people receive. I hear their stories with the work I do, and some of them are horrible, but I was fortunate not to receive that kind of abuse. So when it was time for me to transition, my main goal and objective was simply to learn that it was okay to think for myself. So I had never had any long-term relationships, even before 28. The type of relationships I had been very rocky, to say the least. And at 28, I went through a process where really I just accepted things that I had known for a very long time. I was living in a different community. I had gone to college. So I had had that space to think more for myself. And
while you
for me, I made a simple transition.
While you were living at home, I mean, I hear you saying that it was simple and you didn't have the kind of horrifying stress that many people have, but I'm just wondering, as you were growing up, did your parents expect you to go out and date? Were you supposed to have a girlfriend? Were you supposed to go to the prom? What kinds of things, if any, did they expect there, in their view, young white male heterosexual son to do?
Well, this is what I was getting at when I said that I didn't learn skills. I think a lot of things were simply assumed. I never remember a conversation at my home about dating, about marriage. Everything was absorbed by example. I was the youngest of four sons, and I saw what they did, and I suppose I was supposed to learn by them. The Southern culture is interesting because we don't talk about a lot of things. And even when it comes to something negative, we say if we don't talk about it, it doesn't exist. So something uncomfortable or something that we don't like, in most cases, we're a very polite culture, and we just don't talk about it. But when I was 28, I looked back and I realized, well, really, not until I was about 35, after I had also had some horrible experiences in the gay community, I looked back at why, and I thought, I never had those conversations. Literally, they just weren't there.
So when you decided to be the person you are, even though you were relatively well into your adulthood, in a lot of ways you were a babe in the woods, it sounds like, when it came to relationships.
Absolutely. I was probably about, from the youth I've worked with since then, probably like some 13 and 14 year olds.
Mm-hmm. So that's got to
feel... I had a dream. I had an image of what I thought the perfect relationship should be, which I'm sure most young people have. But I had never gone through the trials and errors of understanding that that wasn't reality. So when I started trying to have relationships, I went in them very naive and very idealistic.
And how did you come out of them? Were they very hurtful?
I came out of them extremely wounded, and the substance abuse started, and it got worse and worse. And at first, I'm sure most people use substances because they make you feel good. You enjoy them. But after 10 years of that and more bad relationships, I was eventually just doing them not to feel pain.
So it sounds like on different levels, really, throughout your life, you were experiencing a measure of pain in different degrees almost throughout your life until you came into your own and you were able to be the person you are.
I don't remember feeling pain or trauma as a child or a teenager, because, quite honestly, I didn't understand options. Homosexuality, certainly gender, were never discussed. They were just not part of the culture that I was part of, so I didn't even really understand that there were truly options. Every now and then you heard about someone being gay, but there's no community here for LGBT people. It's not like Fort Lauderdale or New York or San Francisco in any way at all. So that's another problem with the community here, that we don't understand what a community like that would be like. So I went through my youth, my teenage years, doing heteronormative activities and just fitting in, and really until I was about 25 years old, expecting to be married to a woman and having that life. So it wasn't until about 25 that I really started struggling, and at 28, I made that, I came to that understanding. It's difficult to say a choice, because my choice was never to be or not to be homosexual.
Right.
The choice was to allow myself to be that, to be who I am.
So, I would just like to underscore that, because as we know, there are still people who believe, many people who believe, that homosexuality is a choice, that you can choose to be gay one day and you can choose not to be gay another day, and hence, you know, some of these therapies where they're supposed to reverse your sexuality abound in many ways. And just, again, to clearly state, it is not a choice.
Correct. That's why I realized I needed to be careful about that. Reparative therapy, as you were mentioning, is extremely dangerous. It is totally unaccepted professionally. And my choice was not to be homosexual. My choice was to allow myself to embrace who I am. And many people don't make that choice. Many people go on through their lives living in the closet, living what we call on the down low, being married, having children with a person of the opposite sex or gender. And I've known many of those people. And I was just thankful when I came into who I am that I had not made that mistake, because I would not have wanted to possibly hurt my family, the person who would have been my wife, and the people who would have been my children.
Well, and you know, certainly I've seen many of those situations in my office, and it's true that it's complicated and it's painful, particularly when it's gotten to the point where where they're married with children.
Right.
James, we're going to take a break, and when we come back, I'd like to talk about the story of Daniel Ashley Price. He's not local to you, but I think it will give our listeners a very clear understanding of what one could theoretically experience when you're coming out, particularly with family or friends who are not interested in hearing your truth. We're going to take a break, folks, and we will be right back with James Robinson, who is the founder and executive director of Free to Be out of Huntsville, Alabama. We'll be right back. James Robinson, I'd like for you to tell us a bit of the story of Daniel Ashley Pierce. And this is not someone that you know personally, but this is a story that garnered a lot of attention for a bit, and I think that it speaks tremendously to the impact of coming out with people who perhaps aren't so loving as one would hope. Talk about Daniel Pierce.
I would like to encourage everyone to go online to YouTube and find Daniel's video, because this is an excellent example of how religion used badly contributes to oppression and abuse. Daniel is a young man living, last I heard, he was living in an Atlanta suburb, and he was holding his cell phone while he had a conversation with family members. It's a very difficult video for me to watch, and for, I'm sure, the other LGBTQ people who are watching, and also many of our allies, because what follows is Daniel and I believe it's his stepmother to begin with are talking about his homosexuality, and they're screaming and yelling. This woman is shouting things about the Bible and sin at Daniel, and it's revolving around him living in their house. And you can hear the emotion in Daniel's voice, the hurt in Daniel's voice. And then other family members come into the room. I believe the father comes in. I believe a grandparent comes in. And more horrible screaming and yelling about the Bible and explicatives used to degrade homosexuals are screamed at this young man. And then there's actually violence, physical violence, that takes place in the video. As I said, it's very difficult for me to watch because I'm all too familiar with people who have similar situations. But Daniel captured it on video and shared it for the world to see. And I would like to say, after this, a tremendous amount of money was raised for Daniel online, and he donated it to an agency, a lot of money he donated to an agency in Atlanta called, I believe it's called Lost and Found, for LGBTQ homeless youth.
You know, let me first say that if someone has a sense of their own vulnerability to traumatic experiences, really think about that before you look at this video, because it is very upsetting. It's heartbreaking. But again, if you're dealing with some sort of trauma, this may or may not be the time for you to look at this video right now, this minute, or to at least look at it with someone else. Or if you're in treatment, I would think it would be a wonderful piece to bring into the treatment experience, because it says so much about what people sometimes have to experience.
And I want to add, Daniel was not the aggressor in the physical violence.
And just in terms of the money that was raised, his family told, I think he was 18 or 19 years old, and his family literally told him that he had to get out. So it's interesting that with all the funds that were raised, rather than him taking all of them to get himself established and to live, because his family didn't give him a whole lot of time to get out, he actually donated much of that to another organization to help other people.
Right. There was some question in the beginning about how old Daniel was, and I thought he was about 18 also. But I think he might have been 21.
Okay.
So we're not really sure about that. But that does make a big difference, especially in Alabama, whether you're 18 or 19, with what Daniel would even legally have been able to do if he was in Alabama. But it was a wonderful thing that he gave a lot of money. That's a relatively new organization. And from running a nonprofit myself, I know how important that was, both to the agency and to the people they serve.
Are there many people, would you say, let me back up, is the sentiment the same as it was perhaps 10 years ago? Are we as a country getting better in terms of our understanding of folks who are gay, who are transgender, who are, you know, being whoever they are? Are we getting better at that, or are we getting worse? And in Huntsville, Alabama specifically, what are you seeing?
I think we're getting better. I travel from one end of Alabama to the other, from Huntsville to Mobile, and I do professional development, presentations, speeches all over the state. And I think it's getting better primarily because there is so much more information available. Young people have access to practically everything they would need to know online, both good and bad. And what we need to do is help them sort through those things. But I've been observing it. I didn't come out until I was 45. As a public school teacher, I did not think I could teach in public schools, especially working with elementary school special ed students, and be out. So once that career ended, I created this agency, and I came out, which coming out means publicly became a homosexual. And I not only did that publicly, but I sort of skyrocketed because I created a unique organization which was serving that community. So I've been watching this. I didn't pay much attention to it before then, but this is 7 years later, and I've seen a lot of progress, a lot of conversations happening. You also see very publicly people that I call haters, because they have a platform also, and since so much progress is being made, they're defending their heteronormative privilege, and they do that very aggressively, verbally, some cases physically. Now, Huntsville itself is a unique city in the Southeast. Huntsville's population is very highly educated, generally speaking, because the city grew because of NASA and military. We have some of the highest technology you hear about for the military is developed here in Huntsville.
Really?
So Huntsville is what I call an oasis in the South. We have never had any problems with our Pride events, and the agency also produces Rocket City Pride, and I think about 6,000 or more people came this year. And people here go about their lives in Huntsville. Everyone's doing their own thing, and it's a very accepting city in that respect. It doesn't mean we have support from our city government. It certainly doesn't mean we have support from the government in Montgomery, but in general, the people are much more understanding.
What do you mean you don't? What do you mean you don't have support from the government?
Our city government here in Huntsville, the mayor's office has so far never even given Rocket City Pride a proclamation from his office. I've been at events, one in particular. It was a nonprofit which was religious based, and I sit there and watch a proclamation being given to that organization, which is great public recognition for what they do. And we've asked the mayor for a proclamation to recognize the LGBTQ community, and he has simply said no. This year he did come to our event because it was 1 week after the massacre in Orlando, and we were having a memorial service, and a lot of influence was used to have him come to that event and to speak. That was historic. But it took the massacre in Orlando for him to ever be seen publicly with this population or even mentioning it in any way. And we are basically, like I said, in Southern culture, if you don't talk about it, it doesn't exist. That applies to a whole community. If you don't acknowledge a population and you don't talk about them, you can pretend that their oppression isn't real. You can pretend that there's no need to focus on them as part of the community. And we have been working extremely hard to change that here, and communities across Alabama are working hard at doing that as well.
You know, I think about many people throughout the land who have virtually been rendered invisible by the folks in some sort of power position because they don't want to deal with them. And there's such a mean-spiritedness, there's such an animosity that that gives one the energy to do all that they can to essentially render human beings invisible. And it sounds like that's what you're talking about.
It is. And can I give an example of something that just happened last Friday?
Please.
I was asked to help organize a movement to, not a movement, of course, not a movement, but an event locally, a memorial service to recognize Black Lives Matter. And the mayor's office heard about this, and they called the young African-American man who was organizing a march into the office. I heard about it, so I showed up. And in the mayor's office with city officials, they decided that they were going to add a fallen officer's memorial to this event. I was the lone voice around the table that said, no, this will not work. People are going to be angry. We can't change in 4 hours what we were doing anyway. The young African-American man was in a totally different position because I had been at tables like that before. So I tried to stop it, but my voice alone could not do that. So the march was changed. The event was changed. On our end, we mentioned Black Lives, and we also mentioned the police officers in Dallas who had lost their lives supporting the Black Lives Matter march. When it got to the end for the police memorial, I had to go to the original event, which we had planned, but everyone has told me Black Lives were not even mentioned at the police memorial. So what they did, they also changed the march route. At the very last minute, I asked, and I was told we were going a different direction. Instead of going the more public route, we went down a back street where no one could see this march. So basically, they took the focus away from Black Lives Matter and turned it, even with the media, into the fallen officer's memorial. That's a manipulation like you're talking about, to take attention away from a population.
Right.
At a time when it was very much needed.
And, you know, what it causes me to think about, which unless you hear about things, these things you don't think about, is, yeah, you do have to think about the route, and you do have to think about the, you know, how the march is going to happen, and you do have to think about what your end goal is. What is it that you want to say? And clearly you have to circumvent folks who don't want you to use your voice to say what you need to say.
You do. In a city like Huntsville, well, every different community has its own culture and characteristics. I was, as a white man, I was sitting at a table with people making decisions about an event that I knew I should not even, in this community, be a visible leader. I was trying to help behind the scenes and use my resources that the agency has. And like I said, I tried to change it. They did not even expect me to be at the meeting. They know who I am very well. And I had no influence, and my prediction was totally correct. This community, in many ways, has been torn since that event, with people recognizing, as they're calling it, the city hijacked the Black Lives Matter event. The way we had planned it in the mayor's office, it was going to be more balanced. We did need to recognize the officers who had died in Dallas supporting. And we had agreed to all do that. And in our half of the event, we did just that. But in the other half of it, they didn't do what we expected them to do by making a unified statement on the city's end of it, recognizing that Black Lives do matter. What happened was the original event in a park down the street happened anyway. And more people showed up at it than they showed up at the march and the city event, because it was very confusing. The city very effectively manipulated the situation, because we could not get word out in time to change, and people were confused and frustrated. I think it, in the end, reflects poorly on the city, poorly on a police department that is a very good police department, and it's just very unfortunate that it happened. But other things are planned, other groups are planning things. It was completely peaceful. Both events were completely peaceful. But this is what we face here. They've never done that to any of our LGBT events. Most of the time, I don't even tell them when I'm doing them. We just go hold our rallies and exercise our First Amendment rights, and everything goes fine. But they also haven't felt, I'm sure, that we were significant enough in this community to pay much attention to what we do. But when in a city of about 250,000 people, when more than 6,000 show up at an event such as Rocket City Pride, we began to be noticed.
I would think.
So, finally, right.
Let me ask you this. You came out officially, if you will, at the age of 45. So that's a whole bunch of years living half your life in secret. I think about the young people today, many of whom do come out at an earlier age. I think the older folks have a tendency to be, many have a tendency to really be more reticent, really be concerned about their jobs and their family, and it's very painful. For the younger kids, though, who are perhaps in school, is there any guidance that you would think to offer them in terms of their decisions with respect to coming out?
In our program, and in Huntsville, in the past 6 years, we've seen over 150 teenagers come to our group. And in Mobile, since February, we've seen over 20 different teenagers come. And when young people talk about coming out, we never advise them to come out. We share our stories. We share the great things that can happen, and we share the negative things that can happen. And then we tell them, we will support you with whatever decision you make. There was one case that I did advise a young man to wait a couple of years to come out. He was the son of a colonel in the Army. He knew he would probably be kicked out of his house if he came out. So we worked with him, and he made the decision to wait. His college education fund, everything was depending on this. And when he did come out, it happened exactly like he thought it would. His father told him he was no longer welcome in his house, and he had to leave. And he left at an age where he was a legal adult. In Alabama, you're not a legal adult until you're 19, but at 18, a parent can choose to stop providing support. A very strange situation.
That is a strange situation.
And then legally, if someone like myself, if anyone steps in for that person between 18 and 19, unless a judge has emancipated them, we could be arrested if those parents choose to file charges for interfering with their parental rights. So we have a very shady area there.
It sounds shady indeed. James, we're going to take a break, but when we come back, we will continue with this conversation. Folks, this is Pamela Brewer. You're listening to Mind Talk and a conversation with the executive director of Free to Be, James Robinson. Don't go away. We'll be right back. James, I'm really struck by that sort of year in between 18 and 19 where somebody could literally fall through the cracks, and it's kind of a big crack.
They do. A parent can tell an 18-year-old, and they can do it legally, to get out of my house. I'm not going to support you. But that person, until they're 19, cannot sign a contract. That means they can't sign a lease. They can't do anything that they would need to do legally as an adult until they're 19.
So what do these kids
and
do?
Some of them leave home because they're forced to, and they end up in other cities. What young people in smaller communities tend to do is go to bigger cities, go to Atlanta, then they make their way to New York or Chicago or Los Angeles. That's why the homeless populations of LGBTQ youth in those cities are huge. Even Minneapolis has a huge population on the street.
And I would think
we
that
do
that,
not have.
I would think the trafficking population with respect to the LGBT community is pretty large as well. Simply, particularly in this blank year between 18 and 19, is that true or no?
I don't know the statistics, but I know human sex trafficking in Alabama is becoming a huge problem. We have major interstates, like all states do, that run through here. And Atlanta is a hub. And Atlanta, from the major interstate connection in Birmingham, is only 2 hours away. And then New Orleans is next. And Nashville, we're very centrally located in the Deep South. And the population is growing. Our agency in the past year began recognizing the significance of human sex trafficking in the area, and we have started attending more and more workshops to get more involved in serving people who have been trafficked and helping them be recognized as victims, not criminals, and to participate locally in the efforts to stop that. The transgender community is very susceptible to trafficking because the transgender community in this area has no health care resources for transitioning. We do not have a doctor in Huntsville that will provide hormones for hormone replacement therapy. A clinic just opened in Birmingham this past year to help with this. Most people go to Nashville or Atlanta for those services, but you have to have insurance, you have to have money. So if you are a person who is transitioning, and this is not optional for many people, it is a quality of life situation, because many people look in a mirror and they do not see themselves, and that's called dysphoria, gender dysphoria. And for some people it is so severe that they will kill themselves if they can't transition, or they will mutilate their bodies if they can't get medical care. So it is a quality of life issue. And if you're trying to get hormones and you can't get them legally, you may get them illegally. And in Alabama, as in many states, it's very difficult to get a sex marker on a driver's license changed. So, for example, if you're a male-to-female transgender person and you are living as a female, but your driver's license still says male and your name still says male, you can almost never get employment in a place like Alabama. And our state did not accept President Obama's Medicaid expansion. So there are hundreds of thousands of people here with no insurance. I was one of them for a year. And so medical care for that population, because you can't be employed and you also don't have any medical insurance, is almost non-existent. So when you can't have employment, you have to survive. And survival sex is often part of that, and that is often a trafficking situation.
You know, it's really striking, stunning, the way in which we as a community, as a country, find ways to kill each other, quite frankly. If you can't get a job, and if you can't get insurance, and if you can't get care, what are you going to do? I mean, there's not a whole lot healthy or safe.
Right. I think it's interesting to look at it from the perspective of the lengths privileged populations will go to oppress and abuse other populations in order to maintain their status.
Indeed.
To maintain their privilege.
So we're...
And we need to begin looking at things this way. There is purpose behind this. There is purpose behind a city like Huntsville not having a decent public transportation system. There's purpose behind communities being economically segregated with the amount of resources that get to them. And those of us with privilege need to be brave enough and human enough to be willing to give that up when we look at the suffering that that our friends and, in many cases, family members are even experiencing. And my privilege is so great in Alabama that I have not had negative impacts because I came out as a gay man. I work for an agency that I created. So that is one protection. But I would still be able to find employment because of my status. And I have noticed that over the years, that I expected more consequences when I came out. But my white male privilege as a person with a master's degree is so great that I haven't had consequences. That can tell you one example, because many people who come out do not share my experiences.
Many people who come out, in fact, who are of color, absolutely don't share your experience and suffer loss of family, of friends, of employment, of their religious community. And it's never stated, this is why we are no longer allowing you to participate.
Right.
But
this happens regardless of ethnicity, but it is more complicated and more expensive in minority populations such as the black population. Alabama is what is called a right-to-work state, which means that as an employer, if you worked for me, you could come to my office today and I could say you're fired, and I don't have to give you a reason. It doesn't have to be stated. So it's very easy not to state a reason.
What about the incidents of domestic violence within the LGBT community in terms of police response?
This is something that we've been talking a lot about in Alabama, and actually, I'm rather pleased. Yesterday, I went to Birmingham to the U.S. Department of Justice and met with many employees of the U.S. Attorney's Office. They called an LGBT forum to talk about these very issues. I've worked a lot with the FBI. I've been able to train police officers from several different police departments by working with the Alabama Coalition Against Rape. There's a long way to go, but many people have had education. I called the city of Huntsville several years ago to the mayor's office, and his administrator pointed out to me that all of their people had been trained on diversity issues. And in fact, I've never had an issue personally. I know community members who have had issues. What happens in domestic violence situations, and many of them when they're reported, a police officer, if they cannot make a clear judgment of who is the aggressor, arrests both people so that can be sorted out, hopefully correctly, later. This happens regardless of the genders of the couples. And in rural places in Alabama, I have had reports from people of same-sex couples that the police would not even take their report when they called in for help. We have a long way to go. In Huntsville, this is not the issue because we work closely with our police department, and if it was an issue, we would be able to advocate on their behalf. But in rural communities, when you get 30 or 40 minutes even outside of Huntsville, it's very difficult for LGBT people to get, in many cases, the same response from law enforcement that others would receive, that the privileged population would receive.
Gotcha. What happens in schools? What do you say to, I mean, I understand that you have support groups for young people. For that young person who's going to school and they choose to come out or are outed, what are their resources?
In Huntsville, we have about 5 active gay-straight alliances right now in our schools. I think Mobile has one. Birmingham has several also. Outside of that, there may be some, but I'm not aware of them. In those schools, they have those peer support groups, but many students aren't comfortable going to those. I encourage them to go to a counselor, but that is often not helpful. As a former special education teacher, I am also the most public advocate for students in this community, regardless of their sexual orientation. I successfully filed a complaint with the U.S. Department of Education's Office of Civil Rights against the Huntsville City School System, which took 2 years to resolve. They didn't rule in favor of the complaint, but we never expected them to. But the complaint was all we could do to get the school system to answer questions about what happened. We know what happened from the very beginning, but the school system tried to cover it up.
What did happen?
And there was a junior ROTC class, and the instructor, who is employed both from the military, they're usually retired, and they're working as instructors in public schools, talked about his personal views of the Bible and homosexuality and how it wasn't acceptable. So the person who was part of one of our youth groups complained about this because she didn't want a person to commit suicide after hearing something like that. So we went to the principal, the mother, and the student, and I, and tried to find out what was going to be done. And I immediately, the next morning, started contacting the Board of Education also. Because up until that point, I had been working hand-in-hand with them. But at that point, they shut that door, because I let them know this was not going to be tolerated and they weren't going to sweep it under the rug, so to speak. Well, they tried to do that, but I have great contacts with the media, so the media began covering this immediately. And an attorney from South Alabama called me, who worked for a school system, and he said, "We're not having this conversation, but this is what you need to do. You need to file a complaint with the U.S. Department of Education." And so I did, and for 6 months, a public battle went on between me as the visible spokesperson and the attorneys and the school system. And then the investigation was opened, and it got quiet for 2 years. But in that, in the ruling, I learned about another investigation. Things are just covered up here. Right now, we have a young person who is talking to the U.S. Department of Justice, who is a transgender student who is just having a horrible situation. This, and when I said I would encourage you to go to a counselor, and but that's not always successful, this is one of those situations. This young person has a great relationship with her counselor, and after failing a PE class because she simply didn't attend because she couldn't go as herself, this counselor had her placed in a female gym class. She had friends in the class. Everything was going fine, except the instructor was the problem. This young person had researched their rights and was willing to make a very comfortable compromise for her and asked if she could use the staff bathroom to change into her gym clothes. Well, that instructor refused to let her do that and instead sent her across campus to change, I believe, at a clinic office. And then she had to walk back to class. And often this instructor, while she was gone, would decide not to have the other students dress out. And then this student would walk back in, being the odd person out, and this turned into a very bad situation of bullying. The principal would not do anything about it. The student and the counselor went to talk to the principal, and she would not even meet with them. So that counselor tried to do all she could, but her influence was limited also. So our counselors have been working with this young person, contacting the U.S. Department of Justice, and now they're involved in the situation. So I certainly hope it comes out. But the young person's parents are also not supportive. So it's a very tricky situation for this young person. But she was about to just drop out of school.
So
she did not feel safe.
In many ways, as far as we've come is as far as we've not come. James, I'm going to ask you to share with our listeners your web address in case folks would like to know more about what you're doing and perhaps even being in touch if they need your assistance in some way.
We spell free to be with the number two, not the word two. So it's www.freetobe.org, F-R-E-E, the number two, the letter BE.org.
Okay, wonderful. James Robinson, founder and executive producer of Free to Be, thank you so much for joining us. You have a standing invitation to return. Please know that. And we will continue this fight.
Thank you.
It's a fight that must be continued. And folks, thank you for joining us on this edition of Mind Talk. Mind Talk is produced by Jim Brown and 26x2 Communications. Mind Talk comes to you daily as an educational public service and is available on demand at mindtalk.org. That's mindtalk.org. If you'd like to be in touch with me directly, you can send me an email to Pamela, P-A-M-E-L-A, at mindtalk.org. This program, as an educational program, is not intended to replace any work that you might choose to do with a licensed medical, mental health, or other professional. I would also like to thank Lisa Evergen for bringing James Robinson and freetobe.org to the attention of Mind Talk. You can make your own recommendations by simply sending an email to booking, B-O-O-K-I-N-G, at mindtalk.org. And folks, I would remind you once again, if it's unacceptable, then it is absolutely, completely unacceptable. You take care.